I talk about this great episode of Friends where Joey and Phoebe are having an argument. Phoebe was claiming that Joey was just being selfish. And he said, well, you're really selfish because you went and had your surrogate babies for your brother. And she's dumbfounded. And he says, well, look, it made you feel better. And she said, yes, of course it did. And he said, well, therefore, that makes you selfish. So I think that's the kind of, you know, the irony of the whole kind of thing about altruism. Is it ever really a truly altruistic act?
In this interview, I'm joined by Professor Bruce Hood. Bruce is a professor of developmental psychology at the University of Bristol and has been a research fellow at Cambridge University and UCL, a visiting scientist at MIT, and a faculty professor at Harvard. He is the author of several books, including Possessed, The Self-Illusion, Supersense, and most recently, The Science of Happiness, which this interview focuses on. Expect to learn how malleable our happiness is and the extent to which we can influence it later in life, the counterintuitive skills and habits of happiness, including striking up conversations with strangers, the self-illusion and the distinction between the I-self and the me-self, the role that altruism and secure attachment play in the happiness equation, and more. You can follow Bruce on Twitter at Prof. Bruce Hood and get a copy of the book at bit.ly/Bruce-happiness. I'm joined here with Professor Bruce Hood, who is Professor of Developmental Psychology at the University of Bristol, and he's the author of a new book, The Science of Happiness, which we're going to be speaking about today. So Bruce, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Great to see you now.
Okay, so to get started, can you give us your definition of happiness?
Oh gosh, that's a tough one to begin with. I think it means different things to different people, but for me, my definition of happiness is a sense of things are okay, I'll be okay, and the future will be okay. So I talk about it in a much more subdued notion, in contradiction to kind of what you may read about, you know, this notion of elation and joy, and because happiness covers so many different things. In fact, when we were considering putting a course together for the students, we came up with different ideas, calling it, you know, mental well-being, subjective happiness, awareness. But we just decided to call it happiness because it's something that it's a common word that everyone understands, and it sort of captures that positive aspect of mental life. But more technically, happiness really does cover this sort of subjective sense of emotional well-being. But there's also a more cognitive component, which is to do with satisfaction, feeling that you're progressing. And I think those are interesting components or facets of the same thing in many ways. But for me, I kind of just, as you asked me what I think about when I think about happiness, it's just, you know, I'm content rather than being in, you know, elated or deliriously happy.
Yeah, I don't think it's possible to maintain elation for any reasonable stretch of time. So I think contentment's a much better thing to aim for in the long
yeah.
run.
Yeah. And we talk about that actually, you know, the whole point that it's just the way the brain works, that you have to have these, you have to have the up and the down, you know, you have to have the contrast in order to notice the difference. And if you were constantly in a state of delirium, you'd be kind of probably clinically manic, which is not exactly the best way to live your life.
Definitely not. So if people get just one thing from our conversation today, what would you hope that would be?
I think that, we get so caught up with this sort of need to be seen to be, you know, progressing. We get, you know, really obsessed with, are we, you know, hitting the mark? Are we really achieving, you know, where we want to be in life? And what I want people to do is to kind of read this book and kind of recognize that there's no simple solution. There's no quick fixes. I make the comparison with physical health, that mental health requires effort. It requires you putting in the hours, and you will get setbacks. But even though you may have the setbacks, over time, you will end up living a happier life. And I think, you know, I say that with conviction because initially I was a skeptic about this whole field. When I decided to go into this field, it was really in response to my students. And I didn't really believe that kind of positive psychology would have any long-term impact. But we've been looking at now at 5 years, and we just actually completed a paper, which is coming up next year. It's coming out next week, actually, looking at the long-term impact of everything that we do. And I'll just give you a heads up. The bottom line is actually, yes, our courses and these activities do make a difference, but unless you're prepared to keep up with the sort of interventions, then you go back down to baseline again. So we found that our students followed up 2 years later. A lot of them had returned to their initial levels. But for those who had kept up with the activities that we recommended, they had maintained and sustained their elevated levels of well-being up to 2 years later. So in other words, the message for your readers, getting back to your original question, is that don't expect success overnight. But if you put in the hours, over time, you will start living a more fulfilling life, I believe.
Has writing this book and teaching the course impacted your own subjective well-being in any way? And if so, how?
Absolutely. I think probably the thing I've done is, I mean, I've also gotten older as well, but I've become a bit more aware now of my own drives and my own aspirations. And I'm starting to take and pay more attention to the world around me. I mean, that's really one of the central themes of the book, that we tend to live a very egocentric life. We have this worldview from the first person perspective. This is how consciousness works, and this is how we're born. But if we're so self-centered and we're so inwardly looking all the time, ultimately that will lead to unhappiness. And really, I think the secret to just about every positive psychology intervention is really shifting that focus away from the internal dialogue that many of us have, which is invariably negative. We can have moments of positive self-congratulations, but a lot of the time, given the way that our brains are really focused on problems, if we are always inwardly looking all the time, then I think that's a kind of a problem. So for me, I've definitely become more aware of life outside of myself, if you like. There's a chapter called Get Out of Your Head. And it is really this sort of, growing awareness that there's so much out there that we just miss because our attention is, we're on autopilot a lot of the time, and we're just not really paying attention to the important things. And I know this is nothing new. I mean, this is captured in all these sorts of cliches, wake up and smell the roses and all those sorts of things. But the way I've tried to explain this in the book is to, first of all, based on studies and some of the neurophysiology that we understand what's going on, it's all evidence-based, everything I'm saying, but put it into a framework, which I think was actually never really self-evident, or it was never very clear in the literature. People say, oh, go and do gratitude, or go do kindness, or meditate, or, all these sorts of things, which are all supposed to be good for you. There was never really any unifying theme. And that's why I thought a book which was really talking about the development of self, the evolution of our species, this kind of contradiction between being very sociable but yet very competitive, how that sort of plays out. So I think that's really kind of the contribution to the field, as it were.
For sure. It's not like your usual happiness book anyway, and I didn't see much in there about the usual things like gratitude and all the rest. They are important, but it's been said and said 1,000 times. Something else that I can't help but notice there, so I could see your books behind you there.
I see
Super Sense. I see Possessed. I see The Self-Illusion.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, is there a central thread that has woven through all of these different books that you've written that you've picked up on?
Yeah. So I think, yes. I apologize for the shameless promotion. Apparently it might trigger some people to look at my other books, but the central thing, I guess one of the things which all my books share, is trying to take things which are taken for granted, which look familiar, that so familiar that we don't even kind of even think about them, and then try and present an alternative viewpoint that gives you insight into what's going on. So the first book was about supernatural belief, and I provided a developmental story there, and then the next book was about the self-illusion. Again, this is something that, up to that point, not many people, unless you're a philosopher, would even question the notion of what is the self. And then the book on the domesticated brain, how we actually have been self-domesticating, and then possessions, about ownership, something that, you know, we just use every day, but we never really consider how weird ownership is. And I suppose what I'm saying is that everything I've written about, I've approached with, well, this looks familiar to you, but actually what's really fascinating is are all these mechanisms that you probably never thought about that actually explain some of the peculiarities of ownership and belief in the supernatural and so on. And so that's really what I've tried to do in my writing, is to take things and just cast them in a new light that people wouldn't have normally considered.
Very cool. Now, let's take the opposite approach here. So the book's about the science of happiness, but
yeah.
Something I wanted to ask you is, if you were giving somebody a prescription for a miserable life, what would be the key points that you'd recommend that they do if they wanted to be absolutely miserable?
Well, that's a great question. I didn't anticipate that. How to make someone miserable? Okay, well, just let me just give you a little bit of a history behind positive psychology, because I can't take credit for it. It's a field that's been going for at least 30 years before I jumped into it. Marty Seligman is often credited as being one of the kind of pioneers of the field, along with Csikszentmihalyi and Ed Diner and a bunch of others. But interestingly, the emergence of the movement has all been kind of placed on his presidential address to the American Psychological Society, because Seligman had been working on depression for many, many decades. And apparently, it's maybe an apocryphal story, but he talks about when his daughter said, "Daddy, why are you working on misery? Why you should be working on happiness?" And he had this kind of epiphany that, yeah, maybe I should be working on happiness. So it's sort of the basic of what your question is. What is it about? What is it about happiness, and how do you actually make someone miserable? Well, the answer is, actually, we do know. A lot of it is well established. Things like taking away control. Control is probably one of the central things, I think, in happiness. When you take control away from people, you put them in circumstances such as you imprison them, or you put them in dire financial straits, then this induces anxiety. Part of our emotional systems are really drives. The word emotion and motivation have the same origin, which is means to move. And so our brain is motivated to solve problems and avoid conflicts. I mean, ultimately, the brain is here to kind of make sure that we live long enough to propagate our genes. So we're on the lookout for problems all the time to solve. And that's why we have a negativity bias that I talk about in the book. And to kind of get the urge to do anything, we have these emotions which motivate us to do things. So that could be fear, it could be fright, it could be all those sort of negative things, which are really warning signals saying, look, you've got to do something to change it. But if you put people in a situation where you take away the ability to cope, then that induces stress. So when you take away that, you get this perception of no control. And interesting, it's not the actual control, it's the perception of the control. So there's a long history of studies showing that when you tell people that they have control over a situation, they'll be able to tolerate much more stressful situations. So classically, people can tolerate greater pain thresholds if they think they can terminate at any point in time. But when they're told that they don't have this ability, then they find it much more aversive. So I think that's one thing. The second ingredient for our misery cake is, isolation, which goes against a lot of our history as a species, which really depends on the emotional interactions with others. We know this, of course, from some of the classic work on attachment theory, and developmentally, we know that if children have impoverished early beginnings, this has long-term consequences on their emotional well-being. And obviously probably one of the most dramatic examples of that is the work done on the Romanian orphans out of past 30, 40 years. Well, they're 30-year-olds now, these orphans. But Michael Rutter, the psychiatrist in London, studied these children and showed that even though they may develop eventually equal intellectual abilities and they recover a lot from their early social impoverished environments, they still have a legacy of personality deficits. So it's I think social isolation is probably in many ways the most aversive thing you can do. Nelson Mandela wrote about it famously in his autobiography, The Long Walk to Freedom, that he knew prisoners who would rather be tortured physically than spend time in solitary confinement. So I think that social isolation is definitely up there as some of the things to do. So yeah, I think those two alone would make someone a pretty miserable person, to be honest.
So if we flip those around, you know, if you want to be relatively happy, you should aim for a good locus of control over what you're doing, and also to be really socially connected with people around you.
Yeah, well, certainly, I think the control factor is an interesting one, because, as I said, it's a perception of control. And I think that the comparisons or the situations we put ourselves into in many ways can manipulate that sense of control. I talk about social comparison in the book, and part of the problem with social media is it presents unrealistic comparisons. And so you might feel that you're spiraling out of control because you don't seem to have the same level of, control for one another that others have over their lives. Our lives seem to be beyond our own situation. But the trouble is we never really understand or know the full story or the backstory for everyone. So we just assume that they seem to have their act together much better than we do. When in reality, everyone walks around with a legacy of unresolved issues and regrets and things they could have done better and feeling that they haven't what they want necessarily because of our tendency to draw social comparisons all the time. And so the kind of idealized notions of other people's lives.
You mentioned there about the Romanian orphanages that were discovered after the communist dictatorship came down in the 90s. To what extent is lasting happiness possible without secure attachment? Because I interview a lot of clinical psychologists, and it seems to be in mental health, that seems to be one of, if not the most important variable in well-being. So do you think it's possible to have lasting happiness without secure attachment?
Well, I think there are some individuals for whom it's not such a priority. There's always going to be variation, but for ourselves as a norm, I would suggest that, yeah, we do need to have social attachment. We need to have social integration, social supports. And I don't think it's any coincidence that the happiest countries in the world, the Nordic countries, are the ones which have the greatest level of social support. And the ones which are generally less happy and not necessarily financially less well off, but they tend to be more isolated in terms of their interactions. So it doesn't surprise me that the clinicians would argue that that's the case. We all need people, and we all need each other. And as I said, that's sort of one of the things that a lot of positive psychology does. A lot of the interventions are actually really geared towards cementing or consolidating social interactions, so acts of kindness, or just thinking about others in terms of you doing a gratitude letter. That typically gets you to realize your position and your status and the way that you have become, or that you have been, dependent on others in your lives. I think it reminds us that we're not individuals. But then I would also point out that there's moments of contemplative solitude, which can be very valuable as well. I think that we can get a lot out of moments of isolation, just to kind of get our own mental warehouse in order, as it were. I don't think you have to be, gregariously party animal all the time. And I think there are moments of isolation which are very good for recalibrating. And famously, a number of artists have talked about the value of having those moments. But as for hermits and the idea that we could live without social interaction, it wouldn't be good for our species. It's not the way we evolved. I talked about that in the book, about how with our extended childhoods and this need for support, we had to foster you know, good social interactions in order to make those connections. And if we're to kind of talk about what makes, you know, humans so different, it's obviously, you know, it's the big brain and everything like that. But it's the fact that we're a very, very social animal. And you probably know about Robin Dunbar's work arguing that, in fact, that was a consequence of a brain capable of social interactions. And that's why it got bigger and so on. So, yeah, I think I would agree with the clinicians that you've interviewed that attachments, social interactions, fulfilling ones are really important.
Definitely. Now, in the book, you tell the story of your younger years. And for my interactions with you, Bruce, I've known you now probably 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
and you played an instrumental role in actually helping to get the Weekend University off the ground. You introduced me to amazing speakers like Anil Seth and Vincent Walsh and these people that were just such a vital role in getting this thing going. So I'm indebted to you in that sense and always will be. So I just want to let you know that I appreciate that.
Oh, that's remarkable. And that's one of the exercises that we recommend that you do share these moments. And the book is dedicated actually to all the colleagues and students who I have learned so much from, that without them, I wouldn't be who I am today. So yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I think what you're doing with the Weekend University is fantastic. Bravo.
Well, yeah, what I was getting at there, Bruce, is that you've always struck me as a very happy person and someone, you know, yeah, you just seem like quite happy every time I've interacted with you. And I was really surprised to learn in the book that you had an immensely difficult childhood. You know, the stories you tell about your father and him passing and the alcohol and everything. And the question that brought me to you is, you know, how malleable is our happiness? Like, to what extent can this actually be changed? You know, any thoughts there?
Well, yes, and I do talk a little bit about predispositions and heritability and the genetics of happiness. And it's about the same as intelligence. You know, I'm sure you're aware of the behavioral genetics approach to try to unpick what is nature and nurture. And you look at identical twins. And it's not the perfect way of doing it, but it does give us a handle on the extent to which we are really have this biological legacy from our parents. And the bottom line is that yes, there is a genetic component, but it's not determinist. In other words, it requires the interaction of experiences and environments for those things to play out. I think that, you know, there are some people for whom the sorts of things we recommend in the book are probably going to have little impact because they may have a very strong disposition towards depression. And I'm very clear when I talk about these sorts of interactions in my course that, you know, we're not using this as a substitute for anything like clinical intervention. So I think that I would never recommend kind of this kind of light approach, as it were, as an intervention for a replacement for someone who needs clinical treatment. But that said, a lot of the most effective treatments for people with depression are often psychological. CBT, I'm sure you've spoken to many people on that, is not bad. It does work. So I think it as a kind of recipe for living a better life, which is really what the book is about. I think it's more about kind of getting the reader to recognize and calibrate and ask themselves, well, why do I do what I do? What's motivating me? So that's, you know, what the purpose of the book is.
Interesting. Was there anything that really surprised you whenever you were researching and writing this book or teaching the course? Does anything stand out when I ask that question?
Well, yeah, I must admit, I didn't know much about the, I wasn't aware of the default mode network at the time, which struck me as a really fascinating bit of neuroscience. And just to briefly talk about it, it was this discovery that when you're not actually task focused, your brain doesn't take a rest. Actually, it goes into it actually starts to become overly active. And what it appears to be doing is it's ruminating. A lot of the circuitry of the default mode network is involves areas which represent yourself and your others. And I've hypothesized, and actually I don't think I'm out of kilter with other people here, is that what's going on is that, you know, when you're mind wandering, there is a tendency to kind of consider your situations, and that can often lead to negative thinking. That's one of the findings, that the default mode network appears to be have this tendency for rumination. But that things like, and there's a couple of activities which seem to work on this, meditation and things which induce states of flow, and also walking in nature, they seem to attenuate the activity of this default mode network. So that to me was really interesting, and it sort of struck me as a potentially causal kind of mechanism there, although obviously I'm simplifying it in a number of ways.
Interesting. Something else that, you know, I wanted to ask you as well before we get into the more of the content of the book,
yeah,
was, does teaching a course on happiness or writing a book on happiness, is there now a pressure on you to appear happy all the time that is going to be unreasonable? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think that's true, actually. I'll tell you what it is true, because I'm in the middle of the course right now. And so when I'm wandering around the campus, I know that a lot of the students, because a lot of students take this course, and a lot of them have taken it in the past, and they often come up and speak to me. So I'm slightly self-aware and self-conscious now as I'm wandering around, just to make sure I'm not scowling or, not that I would do that anyway, but I think that is an issue. And yeah, you know, I have moments of misery as well, as because you can't be happy all the time. I guess when I'm on the campus, I have to do that. I asked them to wear lanyards, which showed that they were taking the course. Part of the reason was to promote the course, but the other reason was that I wanted to make sure if I spotted any of them, first of all, I could say hello, and that'd be really, you know, great. That'd be a lot of fun for them. But it was also make sure that I wasn't sort of having a hissy fit or something in front of them. So, yeah, although unfortunately it didn't really work that many, because I think the uptake of the lanyards was not as I'd hoped. I think they're a little bit too fashion conscious for wearing these sorts of things. But anyway, when I'm on campus, I do try to walk around with a bit of a smile on my face, which isn't a bad thing, because as I say, you know, being reminded to get out of your own head and stop being on autopilot means that you sort of become more, you know, I hate that word mindful, but it kind of captures that sort of sense of focusing your attention more on your surroundings, which is really, you know, what you should be doing.
Big time. Now, in the book, you say attaining balance between egocentrism and allocentrism is crucial to all aspects of the book. What's the difference between these two outlooks, and why is it so important?
Okay, so this really does come from developmental psychology. This is Jean Piaget's work. He argued that babies are born with no real concept of an external world, and they have to discover that through their interactions. So he described them as being very egocentric. And there are many examples in the literature where you can show that kids seem to have a very, you know, distorted view of the world. They think everyone thinks the same thoughts as them, has the same perspective as they do. It's kind of amusing, but in order to be socially accepted, you have to obviously interact and cooperate with others, which means you need to become more allocentric, and allo meaning other, so that you can kind of consider other people's viewpoints and the fact that they may not have exactly the same thoughts as you. Now, we all progress to that, not everyone. Some people are more narcissistic and remain fairly egocentric. There's some presidential candidates I'd like to kind of talk about as being the extreme narcissists, but they generally don't consider other people, and they just focus on their own view. And whilst these people do exist, they're not the majority, thankfully. And they'd be dreadful if we lived in a world of complete individualist narcissists. So we do need to kind of share this allocentric perspective. But on the other hand, I think it's important to retain a sense of self without becoming completely other focused, because the danger of that is that you can suffer from empathic distress if you're only ever thinking about other people. people sometimes become so absorbed in other people's misery that it can lead to a really dysfunctional way of living, where you just kind of, absorbing everyone else's misery. And I think that's equally bad. So that's what I mean by striking a balance, which is to have a sense of self-esteem, but not so self-absorbed that you don't notice other people around you. And also, I think what's kind of interesting is that the happiness that's derived from those two perspectives differ. So you can do things to make yourself happy, all right? You can have a very egocentric view of sort of hedonism, kind of buying yourself luxury goods, and or you can direct your efforts towards enriching lives of others around you. Now, they'll both make you happy, but they make you happy in different ways. So for example, the egocentric happiness tends to be very short-lived. And the reason is because if you're the instigator, the purveyor, and the recipient of some act of kindness, like if you buy yourself, a box of candy, chocolates, it doesn't have the same impact. Because first of all, it's not a spontaneous act, it's deliberate. And also, you know when it ceases to deliver any kind of joy because you've eaten all the chocolate. And I do this in the class. I actually give out a whole series of chocolates and candies to them. You see, when you distribute it and give it to other people, you don't know whether they like it or not, but they smile and they reciprocate, and you can go away basking in the knowledge that they think you're an amazing professor because you've just made them happy. And I actually, I've had them come back and bring gifts for me as well. So it does seem to have a more sustained, authentic, spontaneous component to it, the happiness that's generated by sharing that with others. So that's why I say that, both are good. You should have a bit of self-care. You should kind of, treat yourself every so often. But if you're going to, if you're going to make a, concerted effort, then I would suggest that you direct it more towards others around you, because this is what Aristotle talked about when he was talking about eudaimonia. He argued that, unlike hedonism, which is Aristippus, which any animal can do, eudaimonia, which is enriching the lives of others, requires a kind of not a moral higher ground, but it does have an awareness of others around you. And not only do you enrich the lives of others by your positive acts, but that just creates a stronger and better society, which is better for you to live in. And I think that's really true. And I was just talking about this yesterday in the lecture. I was talking about the Nordic countries. Yes, they pay higher taxations, but they have a greater social trust. They have a greater sense of community. And they don't feel as worried and threatened as people living in countries where the social support isn't so strong. And I think America, of course, is the candidate here that in its drive for individualism, I think it's compromised the real values that you get from integrated societies.
Big time. Now, you mentioned there about the chocolates. I was actually reading your book on the train, and there was a gentleman sitting beside me, and I had a bar of dark chocolate. I was eating a square, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to offer him one, because one of the things you recommend in the book is to strike up a conversation with strangers.
Yeah.
And something I wanted to ask you about as well, I felt good doing that, and we had a brief chat and stuff. Why does that boost our happiness?
Okay, so there's actually some experimental work here showing that when you perform an act of kindness, it stimulates the very same sort of pleasure reward centers as the ones when you do it towards yourself. I think the example you gave is so common. People are just think it will be awkward striking up a conversation. This is the work of Nick Epley. He's done all these studies showing that people generally predict that striking up a conversation with a stranger will be awfully awkward and really not great. And that's why people tend not to interact in public transport. But then he actually ran a study where he got people to do this. He paid them, obviously, but he got them to either strike up a conversation, remain in solitude, or just do what they normally do. And what happened, and this has been replicated many times, is that the people who are forced to strike up a conversation find out they enjoy it a lot more. The recipients of that conversation, the strangers, they also enjoy the whole thing. So it certainly seems to be the case that the sum game is that everyone seems to benefit when you do that. I would caveat, of course, that you have to be somewhat cautious. You need to read the room. You need to kind of check. And actually, although I recommend it's one of the activities in the book, I am aware that you just need to be sure that you're not behaving in a way which might be considered inappropriate. But in most instances, it will be a pretty positive event. And the reason, as I said, is because this is work looking at what's going on in your brain when you're doing this, is that actually you're stimulating the same reward centers because self and other become merged. This ego allocentric dimension that I was talking about. So in effect, when you're helping others, you're helping yourself. There's a great episode of Friends, the sitcom comedy, which was a big hit during the 90s and 20s, where Joey and Phoebe are having an argument. And Phoebe was claiming that Joey was just being selfish. And he said, well, you're really selfish because you went and had your surrogate babies for your brother. And she's dumbfounded. And he says, well, look, it made you feel better. And she said, yes, of course it did. And he said, well, therefore, that makes you selfish. So I think that's the kind of, the irony of the whole kind of thing about altruism. Is it ever really a truly altruistic act? And arguably, the way I've just framed it, probably not, because if you're getting some, emotional benefit from it, then in a sense, it's not selfless. But does it really matter? I don't think so. I don't think it does matter. I think if both the parties are benefiting from it, then yeah, that's great. And there's a great quote by Abraham Lincoln, when I do good, I feel good, and that's my religion. So I this is, again, something that's been known for a long, long time, that acts of kindness, altruism, not only make others feel better, but make yourself feel better too.
Going back to the Phoebe and Joey example, what comes to mind for me there is, this comes down to our definition of self. So if you define yourself as this, isolated individual ego in your own mind,
yeah,
then it's a different outlook than defining yourself as belonging to something bigger. And you've read a book called The Self-Illusion, which looks at how this constructed self is essentially an illusion. So could you maybe give us your understanding of what the self is and why this is important whenever we're thinking about happiness?
Okay, so people have misunderstood, not everyone, but I think there's a general misconception that illusion means there's nothing there. What an illusion in my terminology is, it's not what it seems. And what I mean by that is that everyone has an experience of an integrated, coherent self with free will. That's the common sense of self. But what I argue in the book is that actually that is constantly changing. It's constructed by context. It's influenced by things that we're not even aware of because often they're unconscious. So in no sense can it be an entity which is independent of its constituent components. And I think that's true because, we are surprised when somebody seems to change so radically through either disease or damage or drugs to the brain, and they're just not themselves. Or if you get something like dementia, people seem to, their personalities change. And so you can see that it is actually a constructed entity in the sense that all these things can be deconstructed. But for me, to define the self, I think of it really as, and I've used this before, it's a serial interface. It's a narrative. It's an actor between the complexity of all the unconscious processes and the complexity of the external world. In order to be able to maneuver and interact and coordinate all these parallel processes, which are unconscious mostly, they're brought to the fore in the sense of consciousness, and that's the experience of the actor. This is the phenomenology of conscious awareness, and I know you've been speaking to now, Seth. That's what we experience as the self, and that is necessary in order to kind of interact, first of all, with each other, but also interact with an ultimately complex external world. So it's a kind of, as I say, it's a serial interface between the parallel worlds of the unconscious processes and the external complexities. And that's what we experience. But nonetheless, it is one which is constructed. It's an emergent property in many ways. It can rewrite itself every morning when we wake up. It seems to have remarkable consistency. We don't even think we'll change. There's a wonderful demonstration called the end of history illusion that people, they can recognize that they were different 10 years ago. So they say, yeah, I used to think something differently. And everyone thinks that. But if you say, will you be the same person in 5, 10 years? Everyone says, yeah, of course I'll be the same person. And that's the irony, of course, because it doesn't matter what age you are, you think you're always going to be the same person in the future, even though retrospectively, we all recognize that we do change. So it's kind of this, it's an interesting, and it's universal, and it's the way that, you know, our minds work. We evolved this capacity for self-awareness, but it is an illusion nonetheless, in that it's not what it seems, because most people, when you ask them about the self, they think they've got this coherent, integrated, non-changing entity with free will and choices and all these things. And I tend towards the camp where we're a little bit more determinist than we appreciate.
Interesting. Can you tell me about the difference between the I self and the me self? And maybe tell us about the story of Clive Wearing here as well.
Yeah, so I think that's a fascinating clinical case. So the I self and the me self comes from William James, who I'm a big fan of his. William James is just one of these giants in the field. In many ways, he's the founder of Western psychology, I feel. He drew this distinction between conscious phenomenology or awareness, called the I self, and the me self is the autobiography of who we are. So if we are asked to talk about ourselves, we typically will give a summary of the autobiography, you know, where we grew up and what our preferences are and what teams we support. This is content information which is stored in our memories, all our experiences. The I self is that conscious awareness of the present moment in time. And that draws upon the repository of knowledge which is stored in long-term memory. So I use the example, if I've asked someone to tell me what their favorite ice cream is, or choose between vanilla and chocolate, you can see the two components of self being operated there, because there's an awareness of being asked the question, formulating an answer and giving a response. That's present moment consciousness. But in order to answer that question, you have to draw upon all your previous experiences and memories of what you prefer between chocolate and vanilla. And that, of course, is information which is stored in the repository. So your sense of self is the combination of that awareness in the present moment working with this sort of repository of knowledge. Now, Clive Wearing has profound amnesia. And in his situation, he cannot lay down new memories, or at least he cannot consciously lay down new memories. For him, his awareness, and he's documented this, is that he lives in the present moment and it lasts for only about 7 seconds. And then he's forgotten what's happened just up to 7 seconds ago. And it's quite distressing. You see him because he just seems to be constantly caught in this groundhog day of suddenly I am aware. So he keeps a diary to try and keep track of his daily routines. And it's just a listing of, it's now 10:45. I am now awake for the first time in my life. And he scores it out, you know, a couple of minutes later, I am now awake now, and then scores it out and so off. So he is in this constant living in the moment without any sense of history other than the information which was stored prior to his injury. His injury was an infection of the brain of herpes simplex, and that caused this profound amnesia. And this happened, I think, nearly 40 years ago. I think he's still alive. But it's a tragic but fascinating case to show the distinction of why we need to, the distinction between I and me self, but why we need to have that kind of communication between the two entities. Because once that's broken, then you become this conscious being, but without any sense of history.
Sure. Now, you tell the story of, or not the story, but there's a quote in the book, and it's a real tongue twister and a mind bender. It's from Charles Cooley.
Yeah, Charles Cooley.
I am not what I think I am. I am not what you think I am. I am what I think that you think that I am. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's recursive. Okay. So I think this is really interesting. I think this is really interesting and relevant to what I mentioned earlier about social media. Who we are is, and especially if we are very socially oriented, and I agree that some of us do vary on this dimension, is really a reflection of how we think we're perceived. And so who I think I am is really what I think you think I am. If we get what I mean. So that's why it's a recursive kind of question. Now, the reason that's interesting for social media is because it turns out that there's a lot being said about it. You know, people are worried about it. We keep seeing it in the news that the current crisis in mental health is because of social media and so on. In fact, the evidence is very equivocal and contentious because the impact on mental health is not well established, despite what we may have read. But, and there's a study, I think a very good one by a bunch of people in Oxford and London, showing that there does appear to be a cohort for whom it does appear problematic. And surprise, surprise, it's adolescents, or it's the sort of 18 to 24 group. And it's in particular those individuals who score very highly on being socially oriented. In other words, who place a lot of value on the opinions of others. And for them, that's why social media is problematic, because it presents this unrealistic view of other people's lives. So you will feel inadequate if you value what other people's opinions are. Another good example is that people take a lot of selfies. For the people who are really socially fixated on what other people think, they don't enjoy the events as much when they're doing the selfies. The reason being is that they're not paying attention to the event. They're paying more attention to getting the photograph just right. And so they're more concerned with how they're looking than actually engaging with the activity. So yeah, the mirror self that Cooley was talking about is this tendency to rely very heavily on the perceptions of others, which of course are in themselves distortions of what you're projecting towards them.
When I was 21, I did a trek to Machu Picchu. It was like a 5-day trek. It was, it was a bit of a struggle to get there, you know, like 5 days, like camping out under the stars and stuff. It was incredible. But I'll never forget arriving there on the morning. We got up like 4 a.m. to like make sure we were first in the park. We get in there. It was amazing. Really just incredible, magical experience. But a few hours later, there was like a busload of like American tourists that sort of just like skipped the trek, just came. And I'll never forget watching this one lady. She comes out of the bus. She's got her iPad. She sort of strolls along and she doesn't really look around her. The first thing she does, she takes out the iPad and she just sets up the selfie. And it's like, you've just traveled halfway across the world and you're more interested in what other people think about you being here than you actually being here. You know, and I think that says a lot about our generation.
Yeah, it is. It's really distorted. And that's the real problem with the technology. It's taken us away from the sheer enjoyment and immersion in the world because we're living our lives online. And I think that's kind of what the issue is. Not the screen time per se. Although if you're on your computer, I mean, I actually ban the phones in my lectures. And when people pull their phones out, I really have a go at them. And I think there's a growing swell of opinion, certainly amongst performers, that they don't want to see their audience on their phones, because it just, you know, there's nothing worse than trying to connect emotionally with someone whose attention is actually diverted entirely elsewhere. So that's the real issue, I think, with social media. Not so much people really concerned about the content, pornography and the extreme content. That's not, I'm not so concerned about that. I'm not suggesting it's trivial, but I'm more concerned about the way it's changing our interactions in a way that's very pernicious.
Big time. Now, you mentioned enjoyment and immersion there and how these technologies are kind of taking us away from that. And something that I was surprised to learn in the book as well is your metal detecting hobby that you have. You know, I thought that was really cool. And you found a coin of Marcus Aurelius. Can you tell us about that and how this impacted you?
Yeah, totally true story. I didn't contrive it for the book. It's absolutely a true story. I used to metal detect as a young boy, and you know, things, I moved away and, you know, I set off on my career path. But during the lockdown, I started to watch videos of metal detectorists again, Actually, on TikTok of all things, I've just been slugging off social media. But of course, I'm equally guilty as charged because I am on there usually. But I remember it rekindled in me the fascination of this kind of strange hobby. And of course, I watched this TV series called The Detectorists on the BBC, which is it's like very soothing, you know, great British comic drama. Anyway, so I took up metal detecting again, and I live in a very, I'm very fortunate. I live in a beautiful rural area of Somerset, and I'm very close to the city of Bath, which is, of course, one of the major Roman cities. Anyway, I was out one day, it was actually on my birthday, and I was detecting on a field, and I dug down and I found a Roman coin, and I had found I'd found maybe half a dozen, but they're all kind of small. But this one was a big one. It's called a Cistercius, which is quite a large coin. And I looked at it and I recognized it because I'd been studying up on the Roman coins. And I realized it was Marcus Aurelius, which he's, for any of the viewers on your channel, he's the one that was in the film Gladiator. He's the one played by Richard Harris, the old wise Roman emperor. He's regarded as the last of the five great emperors. He was, you know, not only very successful, but very highly educated. He was a Stoic philosopher. And I'm a big fan of the Stoics. Stoic philosophers have this view that life is difficult, okay? But it's what you make of it that matters, okay? So you can take control of your destiny. You shouldn't be so obsessed by these, you know, it's really down to you to change your life. So I've always been inspired by that. And it was just suddenly, I just, this is so true. Once I kind of cleaned it off and had a look at it, I thought, goodness, it's Marcus Aurelius, one of my kind of heroes of ancient Greek philosophy. And I found it on my birthday, and I just thought, who dropped this coin? You know, was it a Roman, you know, was it a soldier? Because it was very close to what would have been the old road from, you know, from Bath to Exeter. And I that would be called the Foss Way, by the way. And I just had this profound sense of, well, joy, but also connectivity with the past. And that's why I wanted to end with the book, because I wanted to talk about, that was a moment by myself, but in a sense, connecting to some imagined ancient peoples. And that's for me, one of the big draws about living in this country, that we are surrounded by history, and we tend to just not pay attention to it. And I think once you start to see the bigger picture, once you start to see yourself connected, I find that very fulfilling and calming. I think as I've gotten older, when I was younger, I was very driven. You know, I had a very, my outlook was, you know, I was rushing everywhere. And now as I've gotten older, I've really started to take stock, and that may have been partly with the pandemic, but I've started to really appreciate the things around me. And I think I've benefited for that. So that's why I tried to capture in that story, that sudden transportation 2000 years ago back to ancient Britain.
That's an incredible story. Okay, so just a couple of questions now to wrap up, Bruce. You talk about acts of unconditional kindness in the book, all right?
Yeah.
Now, can you maybe tell us what they are, and maybe we could give a prescriptive act that people that are listening to this can try whenever after listening to this interview, like something that they could try just whenever they're out in their town or city or wherever that might be, that might fulfill the criteria for an unconditional act of kindness.
Yeah. So if we commit an act of kindness with an expectation to be reciprocated, it's not really an act of kindness. If we suspect that someone has done something in order to achieve as a means to an end, that's generally regarded with some degree of cynicism. So unconditional acts of kindness are more powerful. So there's a study by Dan Gilbert, who's mentioned throughout the book. He's an old colleague of mine from Harvard, but he showed these studies show that if you give people, you know, I think it was a dollar coin, it was attached to a card, and it's just given and saying, have a nice day, this is for you, don't expect anything of it. And then he gave another group the same card, but with the information which sort of explained what they were doing. It no longer became a random, spontaneous thing. It was like, oh, okay, you're doing this in order to achieve some, you know, some ends. So when it's explained away, it kind of reduces the impact of it. But if it's kind of unconditional, spontaneous, then it sort of reignites a sense of wonder. You know, that's interesting. Someone has done this for themselves. So I do things like that all the time. I might leave presents for people in various locations. And I just kind of imagine, well, I wonder what they're going to think when they find it. Not large amounts of money or things like that, but I do that sort of thing. And it gets back to what you're asking about, you know, if you're doing acts for yourself and acts for other people. I find that I enjoy that. I do. And you kind of think, oh, no, I think I'd rather keep the money for myself. I'd rather keep the presents for myself. Sure, if that's okay, that might give you a little bit of boost. But if you do kind of make the effort to go out and do it yourself, try and make it as anonymous as possible just to increase or enhance the surprise when people do it. Like, you know, leave something in a book for someone in the bookstore or something like that. You know, anything, it can kind of be nice.
Yeah, I love this. There's a guy called Adam Robinson. I heard he gave an interview in the Tim Ferriss podcast one time. And one of the things he does is he'll go into Starbucks and he'll order his coffee. And then he'll say, right, I want you, he gives them like $10 or whatever.
Yeah.
And he says, I want you to give the person that's three places behind me in the line a free coffee and whatever they want. Okay. Don't tell them it's for me. I just want to watch the reaction. So the person, he sits, has his coffee, watches them. And this just brings him so much delight.
Great. I love that. That's such a great idea. They actually do that in Italy. I actually tried to do that, by the way, a couple of months back. And I went into the, and I said, there's a certain word for it in Italy. But it's very common practice where they'll buy two coffees and it's just a gift to someone spontaneously. But I tried to do that and they just couldn't get their heads around it. The baristas were baffled by the whole process. But I think once, you know, that's a brilliant story. I think that would be brilliant because then you can get to see the reaction. And I think that's even better than trying to imagine it.
100%. All right. Actually, two questions still.
Okay,
the first is geographical differences in agreeableness. I've lived in London and I've lived in other parts of the UK and Ireland, and I do not like living in London. I'm sorry. I find it people to be a lot colder than the rest of the country. And maybe that's my perception, but what do you think might explain differences in agreeableness between London and other parts of the country?
Well, I think there's no single answer here. There's a multitude of issues. I think the biggest problem for large metropolises is inequalities, and I think that creates tensions which lead to kind of fear. And I think that's what's going on. People are generally fearful and don't communicate and don't talk to people when they live in these large cities. So I think that's part of the issue. When you get to a certain size, the commute, I mean, if you go on the commute, you'll just see no one talks to each other. And indeed, anyone who does is considered suspicious or after something as well. So I think it could just simply be, it could be just a consequence of living in density. But I think it needs to be combined with the sense of inequalities, because I don't see why the numbers of people should matter. But I think that when you have perceptions of inequality, then that leads to people being fearful. And then that, I think, just translates into a general apprehension about talking. Now, what's interesting enough, of course, is that, and this is, I'm sure you've seen this, you must have experienced this, when the train breaks down or when there's some event which disrupts that, people then can actually start talking to each other. And it's actually surprising how well they can get on. But everyone goes around with this sort of what's called a pluralistic ignorance, which is the assumption that you shouldn't talk to anyone else. And anyone who does that must be sort of a bit weird. But again, that comes down to a lack of social trust and a fear of the unknown and the expectation that you are going to be perceived as being a threat when in fact that's not the case at all.
For sure. When I lived there, like in the morning, like say I was walking on the street and there were just, you know, it was a neighborhood and there was only a couple of people. If I walked past someone, I would deliberately say hello or good morning. And the reaction was always just like, Like, yeah, it was shock. Whereas where I'm from, like, that, if you didn't do that, it would be, you know,
that's exactly the case. And I, you know, and in Scotland as well, it's not just Scotland. I mean, the north of England as well. But you're right. I think down the southeast, I had a problem. I was in Cambridge for a long time. That was generally what I found. In London, I generally don't like visiting London for those very reasons. But you're right. That's the norm. Is to, if someone goes into a bar in Scotland, you speak to them. You know, it would be considered weird not to do that. And when I was in America, which is again a bit of an irony because they regard themselves as being completely outgoing and whatever, but actually that's only in some circumstances and not others. So there are these cultural norms about what's acceptable behavior. And I think it's partly to do with this, again, lack of trust. Whereas when you live in a smaller community, you have to get on with your neighbors. You cannot avoid them. But in London, of course, you can just get on another tube or avoid them and know that you'll never see them again. So I think that's part, it's the accountability that you have to engender when you live in a smaller community.
Big time. Okay, last question to wrap up. It's kind of like a big picture question, but because you've written this book and you've thought deeply about this, and you're also, in addition to being a professor in psychology, you're also a philosopher. Whenever you look back, let's fast forward to the final day of your life, how will you know that you've lived a good life? What are your kind of metrics there? What will you be thinking about on that last day about, and how will you know you've lived a good life?
Well, hopefully I won't have any regrets. I've made mistakes. I've hurt people. I've done things which I, given the chance, I would change. And I think everyone would have those sorts of thoughts. But for me, I guess my sense of achievement would be contributing to, I think, a greater understanding of what makes us who we are. That's why I'm in higher education. I could have pursued alternative careers. And I've seen people who have pursued alternative careers where it's all driven by finance and, you know, status. But ultimately, that tends to be less satisfying. And, you know, I could die tomorrow. I don't know how I'd feel on my deathbed, in all honesty. But I do take great satisfaction at seeing successes in the students that I've taught over the years. And there's a sort of, I mean, that's one of the things I really love. When I see a paper I've written being cited, then I know I've contributed or I've changed the way that someone else thinks in the world. And that, I think, is an immense, that gives me an immense sense of joy. I came across a paper and they were talking about the self-illusion and they'd applied it in a way I hadn't thought about it. And I thought that not only had I educated someone, but I'd actually changed the way that they thought about something that had in itself led to innovation. So I guess I see this as this endeavor that every academic would like to do, which is to, you know, stand on the shoulders of giants, to use that cliche, but to contribute overall to the advancement of our understanding of who we are and the universe at large.
Well, you're certainly doing that, Bruce, and it's a delight to speak with you again. So I want to wish you the very best with the new book. Where would you recommend people to get a copy online, and where can they find you online as well?
Well, if you have your preferred independent bookseller, because I'm always keen to see, that's fine. But realistically, most people buy it on Amazon, which is understandable. But do take the time to go and see your local bookseller if you get it. I think independent booksellers are a dying breed, and I think they provide a very good service. But if not, you can buy it online. And I'm very visible online. If you Google my name, you'll find me. So yeah, please. I think this is probably in many ways my most important book, because I think it speaks to a much wider audience at a time when we really, it's a time of uncertainty. We're in a world which just seems very threatening. And I think that what I'm suggesting can actually make a difference. So that's why I think it's probably an important book to have.
For sure. Okay. Thank you very much, Bruce, and we'll talk soon.
Great. Thanks, Niall. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you'd like to hear the full version, you can do so with the Weekend University Premium Membership. This gets you access to our master library of over 5 years of psychology conferences, including over 230 talks and interviews with the world's leading psychologists, professors, and authors, unlimited CPD certification, transcripts, quizzes, premium passes for our annual conference, online courses with Richard Schwartz and Deb Dana, and more. The cost is £97 for 1 year, which breaks down at around 27p per day. The best bit is you can try it out for 30 days completely risk-free, as all orders come with a 100% money-back guarantee. If you're interested, please go to twumembers.com for more information.